Psalm 140 verse 1. Deliver me, O Lord, from the evil man. It reads like a clause of the Lord's Prayer, deliver us from evil. David does not so much plead against an individual as against the species represented by him, namely, the being whose best description is the evil man. There are many such abroad. Indeed, we shall not find an unregenerate man who is not in some sense an evil man, and yet all are not alike evil. It is well for us that our enemies are evil. It would be a horrible thing to have the good against us. When the evil man bestirs himself against the godly, he is as terrible a being as a wolf, or a serpent, or even a devil. Fierce, implacable, unpitying, unrelenting, unscrupulous, he cares for nothing but the indulgence of his malice. The persecuted man turns to God in prayer. He could not do a wiser thing. Who can meet the evil man and defeat him save Jehovah himself, whose infinite goodness is more than a match for all the evil in the universe? We cannot of ourselves baffle the craft of the enemy, but the Lord knoweth how to deliver his saints. He can keep us out of the enemy's reach. He can sustain us when under his power. He can rescue us when our doom seems fixed. He can give us the victory when defeat seems certain, and in any and every case, if he do not save us from the man, he can keep us from the evil. Should we be at this moment oppressed in any measure by ungodly men, it will be better to leave our defense with God than to attempt it ourselves. Preserve me from the violent man. Evil in the heart simmers in malice, and at last boils in passion. Evil is a ragtag thing when it getteth liberty to manifest itself, and so the evil man soon develops into the violent man. What watchfulness, strength, or valor can preserve the child of God from deceit and violence? There is but one sure preserver, and it is our wisdom to hide under the shadow of his wings. It is a common thing for good men to be assailed by enemies. David was attacked by Saul, Doeg, Ahithophel, Shimei, and others. Even Mordecai, sitting humbly in the gate, had his Haman, and our Lord, the Perfect One, was surrounded by those who thirsted for his blood. We may not, therefore, hope to pass through the world without enemies, but we may hope to be delivered out of their hands, and preserved from their rage, so that no real harm shall come of their malignity. This blessing is to be sought by prayer, and expected by faith. Verse 2. Which imagine mischiefs in their heart. They cannot be happy unless they are plotting and planning, conspiring and contriving. They seem to have but one heart, for they are completely agreed in their malice, and with all their heart and soul they pursue their victim. One piece of mischief is not enough for them. They work in the plural, and prepare many arrows for their bow. What they cannot actually do, they nevertheless like to think over, and to rehearse on the stage of their cruel fancy. It is an awful thing to have such a heart disease as this. When the imagination gloats over doing harm to others, it is a sure sign that the entire nature is far gone in wickedness. Continually are they gathered together for war. They are a committee of opposition in permanent session. They never adjourn, but perpetually consider the all-absorbing question of how to do the most harm to the man of God. They are a standing army, always ready for the fray. They not only go to the wars, but dwell in them. Though they are the worst of company, yet they put up with one another, and are continually in each other's society, confederate for fight. David's enemies were as violent as they were evil, as crafty as they were violent, and as persistent as they were crafty. It is hard dealing with persons who are only in their element when they are at daggers drawn with you. Such a case calls for prayer, and prayer calls on God. Verse 3. They have sharpened their tongues like a serpent. The rapid motion of a viper's tongue gives you the idea of its sharpening it. Even thus do the malicious move their tongues at such a rate that one might suppose them to be in the very act of wearing them to a point, or rubbing them to a keen edge. It was a common notion that serpents inserted their poison by their tongues, and the poets used the idea as a poetical expression, although it is certain that the serpent wounds by his fangs, and not by his tongue. We are not to suppose that all authors who used such language were mistaken in their natural history any more than a writer can be charged with ignorance of astronomy, because he speaks of the sun's traveling from east to west. How else can poets speak but according to the appearance of things to an imaginative eye? The world's great poet puts it in a King Lear, "She struck me with her tongue, most serpent-like, upon the very heart." In the case of slanderers, they so literally sting with their tongues, which are so nimble in malice, and withal so piercing and cutting, that it is by no means unjust to speak of them as sharpened. Adder's poison is under their lips. The deadliest of all venom is the slander of the unscrupulous. Some men care not what they say so long as they can vex and injure. Our text, however, must not be confined in its reference to some few individuals, for in the inspired epistle to the Romans it is quoted by the apostle as being true of us all. So depraved are we by nature that the most venomous creatures are our fit types. The old serpent has not only inoculated us with his venom, but he has caused us to be ourselves producers of the like poison. It lies under our lips, ready for use, and alas, it is all too freely used when we grow angry, and desire to take vengeance upon any who have caused us vexation. It is sadly wonderful what hard things even good men will say when provoked, yea, even such as call themselves the perfect in cool blood are not quite as gentle as doves when their claims to sinlessness are bluntly questioned. This poison of evil speaking would never fall from our lips, however much we might be provoked, if it were not there at other times. But by nature we have as great a store of venomous words as a cobra has of poison. O Lord, take the poison bags away, and cause our lips to drop nothing but honey. Selah. This is heavy work. Go up, my heart. Sink not too low. Fall not into the lowest key. Lift up thyself to God. Verse 4. Keep me, O Lord, from the hands of the wicked. To fall into their hands would be a calamity indeed. David in his most pitiable plight chose to fall into the hand of a chastising God rather than to be left in the power of men. No creature among the wild beasts of the wood is so terrible an enemy to man as man himself when guided by evil and impelled by violence. The Lord by providence and grace can keep us out of the power of the wicked. He alone can do this, For neither our own watchfulness nor the faithfulness of friends can secure us against the serpentine assaults of the foe. We have need to be preserved from the smooth as well as the rough hands of the ungodly, for their flatteries may harm us as much as their calumnies. The hands of their example may pollute us, and so do us more harm than the hands of their oppression. Jehovah must be our keeper, or evil hands will do what evil hearts have imagined and evil lips have threatened. Preserve me from the violent man. His intense passion makes him terribly dangerous. He will strike anyhow, use any weapon, smite from any quarter. He is so furious that he is reckless of his own life if he may accomplish his detestable design. Lord, preserve us by thine omnipotence when men attack us with their violence. This prayer is a wise and suitable one. Who have purposed to overthrow my goings? They resolve to turn the good man from his resolve, they would defeat his designs, injure his integrity, and blast his character. Their own goings are wicked, and therefore they hate those of the righteous, seeing they are a standing rebuke to them. This is a forcible argument to use in prayer with God. He is the patron of holiness, and when the pure lives of his people are in danger of overthrow, he may be expected to interpose. Never let the pious forget to pray, for this is a weapon against which the most determined enemy cannot stand. Verse 5. The proud have hid a snare for me. Proud as they are, they stoop to this mean action. They use a snare, and they hide it away, that their victim may be taken like a poor hare who is killed without warning, killed in its usual run, by a snare which it could not see. David's enemies wished to snare him in his path of service, the usual way of his life. Saul laid many snares for David, but the Lord preserved him. All around us there are snares of one sort or another, and he will be well kept, divinely kept, who never falls into one of them. And cords. With these they pull the net together, and with these they bind their captive. Thus fowlers do, and trappers of certain large animals. The cords of love are pleasant, but the cords of hate are cruel as death itself. They have spread a net by the wayside, where it will be near their prey, where the slightest divergence from the path will bring the victim into it. Surely the common wayside ought to be safe. Men who go out of the way may well be taken in a net, but the path of duty is proverbially the path of safety. Yet it is safe nowhere when malicious persons are abroad. Birds are taken in nets, and men are taken by deceit. Satan instructs his children in the art of fowling, and they right speedily learn how to spread nets. Perhaps they have been doing that for us already. Let us make our appeal to God concerning it. They have set gins for me. One instrument of destruction is not enough. They are so afraid of missing their prey that they multiply their traps, using differing devices, so that one way or another they may take their victim. Those who avoid the snare and the net may yet be caught in a gin, and accordingly gins are placed in all likely places. If a godly man can be cajoled, or bribed, or cowed, or made angry, the wicked will make the attempt. Ready are they to twist his words, misread his intentions, and misdirect his efforts, ready to fawn, and lie, and make themselves mean to the last degree so that they may accomplish their abominable purpose. Selah. The harp needs tuning after such a strain, and the heart needs lifting up towards God. Verse 6. I said unto the Lord, Thou art my God. Here was David's stay and hope. He was assured that Jehovah was his God, he expressed that assurance, and he expressed it before Jehovah himself. That had need be a good and full assurance which a man dares to lay before the face of the heart-searching Lord. The psalmist, when hunted by man, addressed himself to God. Often the less we say to our foes, and the more we say to our best friend, the better it will fare with us. If we say anything, let it be said unto the Lord. David rejoiced in the fact that he had already said that Jehovah was his God. He was content to have committed himself. He had no wish to draw back. The Lord was David's own by deliberate choice, to which he again sets his seal with delight. The wicked reject God, but the righteous receive him as their own, their treasure, their pleasure, their light and delight. Hear the voice of my supplications, O Lord. Since thou art mine, I pray thee hear my cries. We cannot ask this favor of another man's God, but we may seek it from our own God. The prayers of saints have a voice in them. They are expressive pleadings even when they sound like inarticulate moanings. The Lord can discern a voice in our waitings, and he can and will hearken thereto. Because he is God, he can hear us. Because he is our God, he will hear us. So long as the Lord doth but hear us, we are content. The answer may be according to his own will, but we do entreat to be heard. A soul in distress is grateful to anyone who will be kind and patient enough to hearken to its tale, but specially is it thankful for an audience with Jehovah. The more we consider his greatness and our insignificance, his wisdom and our folly, the more shall we be filled with praise when the Lord attends unto our cry. Verse 7. O God the Lord, the strength of my salvation, thou hast covered my head in the day of battle. When he looked back upon past dangers and deliverances, the good man felt that he should have perished had not the Lord held a shield over his head. In the day of the clash of arms, or of the putting on of armor, as some read it, the glorious Lord had been his constant protector. Goliath had his armor-bearer, and so had Saul, and these each one guarded his master, yet the giant and the king both perished, while David, without armor or shield, slew the giant and baffled the tyrant. The shield of the Eternal is a better protection than a helmet of brass, when arrows fly thick, and the battle axe crashes right and left. There is no covering for the head like the power of the Almighty. See how the child of providence glorifies his preserver. He calls him not only his salvation, but the strength of it, by whose unrivaled force he had been enabled to outlive the cunning and cruelty of his adversaries. He had obtained a deliverance in which the strength of the Omnipotent was clearly to be seen. This is a grand utterance of praise, a gracious ground of comfort, a prevalent argument in prayer. He that has covered our head aforetime will not now desert us. Wherefore let us fight a good fight, and fear no deadly wound. The Lord God is our shield, and our exceeding great reward. Verse 8. Grant not, O Lord, the desires of the wicked. Even they are dependent upon thee, they can do no more than thou dost permit. Thou dost restrain them, not a dog of them can move his tongue without thy leave and license. Therefore I entreat thee not to let them have their way. Even though they dare to pray to thee, do not hear their prayers against innocent men. Assuredly the Lord Jehovah will be no accomplice with the malevolent, their desires shall never be his desires. If they thirst for blood, he will not gratify their cruelty. Further, not his wicked devices, they are so united as to be like one man in their wishes, but do not hear their prayers. Though hand join in hand, and they desire and design as one man, yet do not thou lend them the aid of thy providence. Do not permit their malicious schemes to succeed. The Lord may allow success to attend the policy of the wicked for a time for wise reasons unknown to us, but we are permitted to pray that it be not so. The petition, "A deliver us from evil," includes and allows such supplication, lest they exalt themselves. If successful, the wicked are sure to grow proud and insult the righteous over whom they have triumphed. And this is so great an evil, and so dishonoring to God, that the psalmist uses it in his pleading as an argument against their being allowed to prosper. The glory of the wicked is opposed to the glory of God. If God seems to favor them, they grow too high for this world, and their heads strike against the heavens. Let us hope that the Lord will not suffer this to be. Selah. Here let us exalt our thoughts and praises high over the heads of self-exalting sinners. The more they rise in conceit, the higher let us rise in confidence. Verse 9. As for the head of those that compass me about, let the mischief of their own lips cover them. To the Lord who had covered his head amid the din of arms, the psalmist appeals against his foes, that their heads may be covered in quite another sense, covered with the reward of their own malice. David's foes were so many that they hemmed him in, encircling him as hunters do their prey. It is little wonder that he turns to the Lord in his dire need. The poet represents his adversaries as so united as to have but one head, for there is often a unanimity among evil spirits which makes them the more strong and terrible for their vile purposes. The lex talionis, or law of retaliation, often brings down upon violent men the evil which they planned and spoke of for others. Their arrows fall upon themselves. When a man's lips vent curses, they will probably, like chickens, come home to roost. A stone hurled upward into the air is apt to fall upon the thrower's head. David's words may be read in the future as a prophecy, but in this verse, at any rate, there is no need to do so in order to soften their tone. It is so just that the mischief which men plot, and the slander which they speak, should recoil upon themselves, that every righteous man must desire it. He who does not desire it may wish to be considered humane and Christ-like, but the chances are that he has a sneaking agreement with the wicked, or is deficient in a manly sense of right and wrong. When evil men fall into pits which they have digged for the innocent, we believe that even the angels are glad. Certainly the most gentle and tender of philanthropists, however much they pity the sufferers, must also approve the justice which makes them suffer. We suspect that some of our excessively soft-spoken critics only need to be put into David's place, and they would become a vast deal more bitter than he ever was. Verse 10. Let burning coals fall upon them. Then will they know that the scattering of the firebrands is not the sport they thought it to be. When hailstones and coals of fire descend upon them, how will they escape? Even the skies above the wicked are able to deal out vengeance upon them. Let them be cast into the fire. They have kindled the flames of strife, and it is fair that they should be cast therein. They have heated the furnace of slander 7 times hotter than it was wont to be heated, and they shall be devoured therein. Who would have pitied Nebuchadnezzar if he had been thrown into his own burning fiery furnace? Into deep pits, that they rise not up again. They made those ditches or fosses for the godly, and it is meet that they should themselves fall into them and never escape. When a righteous man falls, he rises again. But when the wicked man goes down, he falls like Lucifer, never to hope again. The psalmist in this passage graphically depicts the Sodom of the wicked persecutor. Fire falls upon him from heaven, the city blazes, and he is cast into the conflagration. The vale of Siddim is full of slime pits, and into these he is hurried. Extraordinary judgment overtakes the extraordinary offender. Above, around, beneath, all is destruction. He would have consumed the righteous, and now he is consumed himself. So shall it be, so let it be. Verse 11. Let not an evil speaker be established in the earth. For that would be an established plague, a perpetual curse. Men of false and cruel tongues are of most use when they go to fatten the soil in which they rot as carcasses. While they are alive, they are the terror of the good, and the torment of the poor. God will not allow the specious orators of Fossed to retain the power they temporarily obtain by their deceitful speaking. They may become prominent, but they cannot become permanent. They shall be disendowed and disestablished in spite of all that they can say to the contrary. All evil bears the element of decay within itself, for what is it but corruption? Hence the utmost powers of oratory are insufficient to settle upon a sure foundation the cause which bears a lie within it. Evil shall hunt the violent man to overthrow him. He hunted the good, and now his own evil shall hunt him. He tried to overthrow the goings of the righteous, and now his own unrighteousness shall prove his overthrow. As he was violent, so shall he be violently assaulted and hunted down. Sin is its own punishment. A violent man will need no direr doom than to reap what he has sown. It is horrible for a huntsman to be devoured by Iris' own hounds, yet this is the sure fate of the persecutor. Verse 12. I know that the Lord will maintain the cause of the afflicted, and the right of the poor. All through the psalm the writer is bravely confident, and speaks of things about which he had no doubt. In fact, no psalm can be more grandly positive than this protest against slander. The slandered saint knew Jehovah's care for the afflicted, for he had received actual proofs of it himself. I will maintain it is the motto of the great defender of the rights of the needy. What confidence this should create within the bosoms of the persecuted and poverty-stricken. The prosperous and wealthy can maintain their own cause, but those who are otherwise shall find that God helps those who cannot help themselves. Many talk as if the poor had no rights worth noticing. But they will sooner or later find out their mistake when the judge of all the earth begins to plead with them. Verse 13. Surely the righteous shall give thanks unto thy name. The former psalm had its surely, but this is a more pleasing one. As surely as God will slay the wicked, he will save the oppressed, and fill their hearts and mouths with praises. Whoever else may be silent, the righteous will give thanks, and whatever they may suffer, the matter will end ill, their living through the trial, and magnifying the Lord for his delivering grace. On earth ere long, and in heaven for ever, the pure in heart shall sing unto the Lord. How loud and sweet will be the songs of the redeemed in the millennial age, when the meek shall inherit the earth, and delight themselves in the abundance of peace. The upright shall dwell in thy presence. Thus shall they give thanks in the truest and fullest manner. This abiding before the Lord shall render to him as songs without words, and therefore all the more spiritual and true. Their living and walking with their God shall be their practical form of gratitude. Sitting down in holy peace, like children at their father's table, their joyful looks and language shall speak their high esteem and fervent love to him who has become their dwelling place. How high have we climbed in this psalm, from being hunted by the evil man to dwelling in the divine presence. So doth faith upraise the saint from the lowest depths to heights of peaceful repose. Well might the song be studded with sealers, or uplifters. Psalm 141 verse 1. Lord, I cry unto thee. This is my last resort, prayer never fails me. My prayer is painful and feeble, and worthy only to be called a cry, but it is a cry unto Jehovah, and this ennobles it. I have cried unto thee, I still cry to thee, and I always mean to cry to thee. To whom else could I go? What else can I do? Others trust to themselves, but I cry unto thee. The weapon of all prayer is one which the believer may always carry with him, and use in every time of need. Make haste unto me. His case was urgent, and he pleaded that urgency. God's time is the best time, but when we are sorely pressed, we may with holy importunity quicken the movements of mercy. In many cases, if help should come late, it would come too late, and we are permitted to pray against such a calamity. Give ear unto my voice, when I cry unto thee. See how a second time he talks of crying. Prayer had become his frequent, yea, his constant exercise. Twice in a few words he says, I cry, I cry. How he longs to be heard, and to be heard at once. There is a voice to the great Father in every cry, and groan, and tear of his children. He can understand what they mean when they are quite unable to express it. It troubles the spirit of the saints when they fear that no favorable car is turned to their doleful cries. They cannot rest unless their unto thee is answered by an unto me. When prayer is a man's only refuge, he is deeply distressed at the bare idea of his failing therein. That were a grief I could not bear, didst thou not hear and answer prayer, but a prayer hearing, answering God supports me under every load. Verse 2. Let my prayer be set forth before thee as incense. As incense is carefully prepared, kindled with holy fire, and devoutly presented unto God, so let my prayer be. We are not to look upon prayer as easy work requiring no thought. It needs to be set forth, or what is more, it must be set forth before the Lord, by a sense of his presence, and a holy reverence for his name. Neither may we regard all supplication as certain of divine acceptance. It needs to be set forth before the Lord as incense, concerning the offering of which there were rules to be observed, otherwise it would be rejected of God. And the lifting up of my hands as the evening sacrifice. Whatever form his prayer might take, his one desire was that it might be accepted of God. Prayer is sometimes presented without words by the very motions of our bodies. Bent knees and lifted hands are the tokens of earnest, expectant prayer. Certainly work, or the lifting up of the hands in labor, is prayer if it be done in dependence upon God and for his glory. There is a hand prayer as well as a heart prayer, and our desire is that tithes may be sweet unto the Lord as the sacrifice of eventide. Holy hope, the lifting up of hands that hang down, is also a kind of worship. May it ever be acceptable with God. The psalmist makes a bold request. He would have his humble cries and prayers to be as much regarded of the Lord as the appointed morning and evening sacrifices of the holy place. Yet the prayer is by no means too bold, for, after all, the spiritual is in the Lord's esteem higher than the ceremonial, and the calves of the lips are a truer sacrifice than the calves of the stall. So far we have a prayer about prayer. We have a distinct supplication in the two following verses. Verse 3. Set a watch, O Lord, before my mouth. That mouth had been used in prayer. It would be a pity it should ever be defiled with untruth, or pride, or wrath, yet so it will become unless carefully watched, for these intruders are ever lurking about the door. David feels that with all his own watchfulness he may be surprised into sin, and so he begs the Lord himself to keep him. When Jehovah sets the watch, the city is well guarded. When the Lord becomes the guard of our mouth, the whole man is well garrisoned. Keep the door of my lips. God has made our lips the door of the mouth, but we cannot keep that door of ourselves. Therefore do we entreat the Lord to take the rule of it. Oh, that the Lord would both open and shut our lips, for we can do neither the one nor the other aright if left to ourselves. In times of persecution by ungodly men, we are peculiarly liable to speak hastily or evasively, and therefore we should be specially anxious to be preserved in that direction from every form of sin. How condescending is the Lord! We are ennobled by being doorkeepers for him, and yet he deigns to be a doorkeeper for us. Incline not my heart to any evil thing. It is equivalent to the petition, lead us not into temptation. Oh, that nothing may arise in providence which would excite our desires in a wrong direction. The psalmist is here careful of his heart. He who holds the heart is Lord of the man, but if the tongue and the heart are under God's care, all is safe. Let us pray that he may never leave us to our own inclinations, or we shall soon decline from the right. To practice wicked works with men that work iniquity. The way the heart inclines, the life soon tends. Evil things desired bring forth wicked things practiced. Unless the fountain of life is kept pure, the streams of life will soon be polluted. Alas, there is great power in company. Even good men are apt to be swayed by association. Hence the fear that we may practice wicked works when we are with wicked workers. We must endeavor not to be with them lest we sin with them. It is bad when the heart goes the wrong way alone, worse when the life runs in the evil road alone, but it is apt to increase unto a high degree of ungodliness when the backslider runs the downward path with a whole horde of sinners around him. Our practice will be our perdition if it be evil. It is an aggravation of sin rather than an excuse for it to say that it is our custom and our habit. It is God's practice to punish all who make a practice of iniquity. Good men are horrified at the thought of sinning as others do. The fear of it drives them to their knees. Iniquity, which, being interpreted, is a want of equity, is a thing to be shunned as we would avoid an infectious disease. And let me not eat of their dainties. If we work with them, we shall soon eat with them. They will bring out their sweet morsels and delicate dishes in the hope of binding us to their service by the means of our palates. The trap is baited with delicious meats that we may be captured and become meat for their malice. If we would not sin with men, we had better not sit with them. And if we would not share their wickedness, we must not share their wantonness. Verse 5. Let the righteous smite me, it shall be a kindness. He prefers the bitters of gracious company to the dainties of the ungodly. He would rather be smitten by the righteous than feasted by the wicked. He gives a permit to faithful admonition. He even invites it to let the righteous smite me. When the ungodly smile upon us, their flattery is cruel. When the righteous smite us, their faithfulness is kind. Sometimes godly men rap hard. They do not merely hint at evil, but hammer at it, and even then we are to receive the blows in love, and be thankful to the hand which smites so heavily. Fools resent reproof, wise men endeavor to profit by it. And let him reprove me, it shall be an excellent oil, which shall not break ray head. Oil breaks no heads, and rebuke does no man any harm. Rather, as oil refreshes and perfumes, so does reproof when fitly taken sweeten and renew the heart. My friend must love me well if he will tell me of my faults. There is an unction about him if he is honest enough to point out my errors. Many a man has had his head broken at the feasts of the wicked, but none at the table of a true-hearted reprover. The oil of flattery is not excellent. The oil so lavishly used at the banquet of the reveler is not excellent. Head-breaking and heart-breaking attend the anointings of the riotous, but it is otherwise with the severest censures of the godly. They are not always sweet, but they are always excellent. They may for the moment bruise the heart, but they never break either it or the head. For yet my prayer also shall be in their calamities. Gracious men never grow wrathful with candid friends so as to harbor an ill feeling against them. If so, when they saw them in affliction, they would turn round upon them and taunt them with their rebukes. Far from it, these wisely grateful souls are greatly concerned to see their instructors in trouble, and they bring forth their best prayers for their assistance. They do not merely pray for them, but they so closely and heartily sympathize that their prayers are in their calamities, down in the dungeon with them. So true is Christian brotherhood that we are with our friends in sickness or persecution, suffering their griefs, so that our heart's prayer is in their sorrows. When we can give good men nothing more, let us give them our prayers, and let us do this doubly to those who have given us their rebukes. Verse 6. This is a verse of which the meaning seems far to seek. Does it refer to the righteous among the Israelites? We think so. David surely means that when their leaders fell never to rise again, they would then turn to him and take delight in listening to his voice. When their judges are overthrown in stony places, they shall hear my words, for they are sweet. And so they did. The death of Saul made all the best of the nation look to the son of Jesse as the Lord's anointed. His words became sweet to them. Many of those good men who had spoken severely of David's quitting his country and going over to the Philistines were nevertheless dear to his heart for their fidelity, and to them he returned nothing but goodwill, loving prayers, and sweet speeches, knowing that by and by they would overlook his faults and select him to be their leader. They smote him when he erred, but they recognized his excellences. He, on his part, bore no resentment, but loved them for their honesty. He would pray for them when their land lay bleeding at the feet of their foreign enemies. He would come to their rescue when their former leaders were slain, and his words of courageous hopefulness would be sweet in their ears. This seems to me to be a good sense, consistent with the context. At the same time, other and more labored interpretations have their learned admirers, and to these we will refer in our notes from other authors. Verse 7. David's case seemed hopeless. The cause of God in Israel was as a dead thing, even as a skeleton broken and rotten, and shoveled out of the grave, to return as dust to its dust. Our bones are scattered at the grave's mouth. There seemed to be no life, no cohesion, no form, order, or headship among the godly party in Israel. Saul had demolished it, and scattered all its parts, so that it did not exist as an organized whole. David himself was like one of these dried bones, and the rest of the godly were in much the same condition. There seemed to be no vitality or union among the holy seed, but their cause lay at death's door. As when one cutteth and cleaveth wood upon the earth, they were like wood divided and thrown apart, not as one piece of timber, nor even as a bundle, but all cut to pieces, and thoroughly divided. Leaving out the word a wood, which is supplied by the translators, the figure relates to cleaving upon the earth, which probably means ploughing, but may signify any other form of chopping and splitting, such as felling a forest, tearing up bushes, or otherwise causing confusion and division. How often have good men thought thus of the cause of God? Wherever they have looked, death, division, and destruction have stared them in the face. Cut and cloven, hopelessly sundered. Scattered, yes, scattered at the grave's mouth. Split up and split for the fire. Such the cause of God and truth has seemed to be. Upon the earth the prospect was wretched, the field of the church was ploughed, burrowed, and scarified. It had become like a woodchopper's yard, where everything was doomed to be broken up. We have seen churches in such a state, and have been heartbroken. What a mercy that there is always a place above the earth to which we can look. There lives one who will give a resurrection to his cause, and a reunion to his divided people. He will bring up the dead bones from the grave's mouth, and make the dried faggots live again. Let us imitate the psalmist in the next verse, and look up to the living God. Verse 8. But mine eyes are unto thee, O God the Lord. He looked upward and kept his eyes fixed there. He regarded duty more than circumstances. He considered the promise rather than the external providence, and he expected from God rather than from men. He did not shut his eyes in indifference or despair, neither did he turn them to the creature in vain confidence, but he gave his eyes to his God, and saw nothing to fear. Jehovah his Lord is also his hope. Thomas called Jesus Lord and God, and David here speaks of his God and Lord. Saints delight to dwell upon the divine names, when they are adoring or appealing. In thee is my trust. Not alone in thine attributes or in thy promises, but in thyself. Others might confide where they chose, but David kept to his God. In him he trusted always, only, confidently, and unreservedly. Leave not my soul destitute, as it would be if the Lord did not remember and fulfill his promise. To be destitute in circumstances is bad, but to be destitute in soul is far worse. To be left of friends is a calamity, but to be left of God would be destruction. Destitute of God is destitution with a vengeance. The comfort is that God hath said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. Verse 9. Keep me from the snares which they have laid for me. He had before asked, in Psalm 141:3, that the door of his mouth might be kept, but his prayer now grows into a keep me. He seems more in trouble about covert temptation than concerning open attacks. Brave men do not dread battle, but they hate secret plots. We cannot endure to be entrapped like unsuspecting animals, therefore we cry to the God of wisdom for protection. And the jinns of the workers of iniquity. These evil workers sought to catch David in his speech or acts. This was in itself a piece of inequity, and so of a piece with the rest of their conduct. They were bad themselves, and they wished either to make him like themselves, or to cause him to seem so. If they could not catch the good man in one way, they would try another. Snares and jinns should be multiplied, for anyhow they were determined to work his ruin. Nobody could preserve David, but the omniscient and omnipotent one. He also will preserve us. It is hard to keep out of snares which you cannot see, and to escape jinns which you cannot discover. Well might the much-hunted psalmist cry, keep me. Verse 10. Let the wicked fall into their own nets, whilst that I withal escape. It may not be a Christian prayer, but it is a very just one, and it takes a great deal of grace to refrain from crying amen to it. In fact, grace does not work towards making us wish otherwise concerning the enemies of holy men. Do we not all wish the innocent to be delivered, and the guilty to reap the result of their own malice? Of course we do, if we are just men. There can be no wrong in desiring that to happen in our own case, which we wish for all good men. Yet is there a more excellent way?